listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. Now, picture the scene. A small group of eccentric creative types work in a decrepit building and come up with an innovative product that sweeps the world, earning millions of dollars. The company sees ups and downs, takeovers, and drama, but that product ushers in a new era. Is it Silicon Valley? Seattle? No, it's Lake Geneva, Wisconsin in the 1970s. The product? A new kind of game called Dungeons & Dragons. Here's a game of D&D in action in the Netflix hit series Stranger Things.
The hooded cultists chant, "Hail, Lord Vecna. Hail, Lord Vecna." They turn to you. Remove their hoods. You recognize most of them from Mokbar. There is one you do not recognize. His skin shriveled, desiccated, and something else. He is not only missing his left arm, but his left eye.
No! No! No!
No!
No!
No!
No!
Vecna's dead.
He killed my cat.
So it was thought, my friend. So it was thought. But Vecna lives.
Vecna lives, and so does Dungeons & Dragons. In his new book, our next guest tells the story of the rise and fall of TSR, the Lake Geneva company that made Dungeons & Dragons, and the buyout that kept the game alive. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you now, or have you ever been a D&D player? Were your kids, your grandkids, were you there at Ground Zero? Maybe even in Lake Geneva yourself? Did you play in the early days? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Ben Riggs is a writer, teacher, and podcaster from Milwaukee, where he teaches English and history. He's the host of a role-playing game podcast called Plot Points, and his new book is called Slaying the Dragon, A Secret History of Dungeons & Dragons. Ben, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be here. It's a dream to be on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Fantastic. Well, glad to have you. Now, you tell the story not just of the creative side of the creation of Dungeons & Dragons, but also the business side. And this was, TSR was in the business papers, you write. What made you want to dig into that side of the story?
So it was a story that demanded to be told. About 6 years ago, I was writing for Geek & Sundry, and I was assigned an article tentatively titled, "Did you know that Dungeons & Dragons wasn't always made in Seattle?" And being in Wisconsin and knowing a bunch of the old hands back here, I was given the job of writing that article. And as I worked on it, one article became three articles, and people started sending me documents in the mail asking to be confidential. I got interviews with people no one had talked to before. So the writing stretched out over 6 years, and I was like, if I don't write this, no one will. And it's a piece of Wisconsin history that has not yet seen the light of day. So it's been a pleasure to write, and I'm really glad that people are reacting so positively to the book.
Take us back to the origin here. We've got this really in Lake Geneva, this local eccentric, as you describe him, Gary Gygax, go from, you know, an out of work cobbler at some points to the creator of this new kind of game.
Yeah, I mean, you could argue that Gary Gygax is the most influential Wisconsinite in our state's history. And yet nobody really talks about him much. Lake Geneva doesn't even have a statue to him. He was an unemployed insurance underwriter fixing shoes in his children's basement, who was designing wargaming rules for fun. And one of his kids told me, you know, he only made enough money from that to like take the family out to dinner once or twice. Then a guy comes down from Minnesota, Dave Arneson, and he shows Gary Gygax what he did with one of his wargames, a wargame called Chainmail. And Dave Arneson took that game and he used it to, he gave players a single character, which was new. They were exploring a dungeon, and these characters persisted from game session to game session and increased in power as they went along. And Gary Gygax was like, "Holy cow, this is amazing. Dave Arneson, give me all the rules to this game." So Dave Arneson sent him between 18 and 24 cribbed and cramped pages. Gary Gygax took that and set about making it into a rule set that would be called Dungeons and Dragons. But again, what he created was so radical, so new, we're still grappling with it today. It's like someone invented acting in 1974. Gary Gygax and Dave Arneson found something new to do with pencils, papers in your brain that no one thought of before. So again, it's one of the reasons that people oftentimes grapple with explaining how to play D&D and what D&D is. But Wisconsin saw the birth of a totally new medium, one in which the player is like the actor and audience at the same time. Again, Lake Geneva, Wisconsin really is a mecca. And again, I feel like we don't appreciate it properly within the state. Did that answer your question?
Oh, yeah. And now this company, TSR, Tactical Studies Rules, it stands for, they end up having this multi-million dollar product. Can you talk about how it went from that germ of an idea to this thing that really just swept the country, including to a young fella named Rob, just coming out of elementary school, if I could age myself?
The growth of the game was exponential. Tactical Studies Rules, TSR, was founded because no other company would publish the rules. They just didn't see what the market for it was going to be. But the ability to take one character and control them and do anything was addictive. I want to say the first 1,000 copies sold out in a little under a year. The second 1,000 copies sold out in like 5 or 6 months. And it really saw exponential growth through 1983, as I recall. Again, it was slowed by the fact that it is really hard to explain how to play, but it's very easy to watch someone play and be like, oh, that's what you do in a role-playing game. It's why role-playing games have really taken off now in the 21st century, because YouTube allows you to watch people play all day long, and that's the best way to learn how to play. But the fact that D&D was so new and such an innovation, that really drove that first burst of growth through the early 80s. And then there was a crisis, and Gary Gygax lost control of D&D and the company, and the game was purchased by a woman named Lorraine Williams, who oversaw the company's silver age through 1997, when it was finally purchased by Magic the Gathering creators, Wizards of the Coast, and took the game out to Seattle, and Wisconsin lost a jewel, sadly, although the Wizards of the Coast, I think, has done a very good job with it. Did that make sense?
Yeah, we're talking to Milwaukee-based writer, teacher, and podcaster Ben Riggs about a big piece of Wisconsin history. His new book is called Slaying the Dragon, A Secret History of Dungeons and Dragons, looking at the invention of a whole genre of games called role-playing game that ended up being influential in lots of other stuff, including computer games. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about the history of the game, what it is, how it works? Are you part of that history? Do you play it now? Did you maybe years ago? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Ben, as you mentioned, there was kind of there have been multiple crisis periods in the history of the game and of TSR. It seems like one problem was they'd come up with this product. They made lots of money at it. None of them really knew a lot about how to run a business, though, in a lot of ways.
Yeah, at TSR, initially you had, again, Gary Gygax was an insurance underwriter and cobbler. You had a pharmacist, you had a pipe fitter, and they were running the company. And, you know, life is well and good when your product is growing exponentially. And then when Lorraine Williams took over, again, she'd worked in business, but her degree was not in business. And she did hire business people, but she tended to hire, you know, like people from the cardboard industry are suddenly working at TSR, dealing with artists and writers. You had one executive come down to Brahm, a genius artist who would create these gloomy landscapes and these intriguing, mysterious characters, you know, but tended to be fairly monochrome. And this executive says to Brahm, now make sure you use all your colors in this painting because it's important, and which is a bit like telling Shakespeare to use more words. There definitely was a gap between the business ability of the people running the company and perhaps what it should have been. Role-playing games are also a difficult business. You know, if you drink a bottle of Miller, if you want more Miller, you have to go buy more. If you spent $30 on Dungeons & Dragons rule books in 1979, you could still be playing with them today and never would have needed anything else. The fact that, you know, this is an evergreen product that never goes bad causes real problems for role-playing game companies, because after you sell it to them once, what do you do? And Dungeons and Dragons has tried to come up with new additions and use that as an engine of growth for the game. And the current edition, fifth edition, is apparently a huge hit. I don't have sales numbers for it, but the Player's Handbook came out 8 years ago, and it's still in like the top 50 sellers on Amazon today. That's crazy. Wizards of the Coast claims that they've had 50 million people experience the game. Even if that means 25 million people have played it, that's tremendous growth. Like I would say that when the game was in Wisconsin, it probably maxed out around 2 million players. So it's grown exponentially since it left the state.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Kathleen is with us in Elgin. Kathleen, hi.
Hi. You're talking about Dungeons and Dragons, and I remember around Halloween of 1985, I worked at a club in Chicago called Limelight, and at the Halloween party, I met a guy, and it was a costume party, dressed like a vampire, asked me to go out for dinner, and I said yes, and on the way home, I realized I have no idea what this guy looks like when he shows up at the door. Well, it turns out he worked for TSR. He knew that I had a young son. And he brought with him, I guess, to curry points with me, every single thing that TSR had put out up until that point. And, I mean, the stuff just kept coming up to the door, box after box after box of stuff. And my son was, like, the hit of the neighborhood for, I don't even remember how every kid in the world ended up at my house, which I'd rather have than him going wherever they would go. And, yes, now he's 50 years old, and he has actually moved out of my basement. He doesn't still live down in the basement playing D&D.
Kathleen, thanks a lot for sharing that story. It's a great story. I don't exactly remember D&D in the 80s being the ticket to popularity, Ben, but it has changed in some ways from being this really niche nerd thing to a lot more people play it than that original core audience.
You know, I hope this might sound silly, you know, I teach 7th and 8th grade, and it was about a year ago, I wandered into the teacher's lounge, and it was filled with women under 30 talking about their D&D campaigns. And again, for me, as a white guy in my 40s, where role-playing games were pretty white and pretty male, it blew my mind. I would honestly tell you, as popular as role-playing games have become, indications are that it's even the rate of increase in players is about to go vertical. The speed of increase seems to be picking up, not slowing down, which, again, is crazy to think about. You know, when you think about how nerdy and niche role-playing games were in the 80s and 90s, you know, you feel glad that they're even talking about them on TV shows. But the fact that, again, I honestly believe that we're about to see a multiple of the number of people currently playing start playing, that is my prediction. Did that make sense?
Sure. Thanks for that call. We're talking to Milwaukee-based writer, teacher, and podcaster Ben Riggs about his new book. It's called Slaying the Dragon, A Secret History of Dungeons and Dragons. It tells the story of TSR, the Lake Geneva company behind the famous role-playing game. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about the history of Dungeons and Dragons or what the heck it is? Have you played it over the last year, over the last five decades? Do you have a memory you want to share? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Ben Riggs. He's from Milwaukee. His new book is called Slaying the Dragon, A Secret History of Dungeons and Dragons. You can join in with your memories, your questions at 800-642-1234. Memories from five decades ago or from a session last night. Rick joins us now in Evansville. Rick, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. First off, I want to let you know that, yes, I did buy the book, and I have started reading it. I've only gotten through the first chapter, but so far it's great.
Thanks, Rick.
Secondly, I used to play back in the day, late 70s, early 80s, you know, junior high, high school. And it was fun then, but it was a little harder to play because you had to make everything up yourself. You're playing there in your head with the rule book, a notebook, and graph paper. Nowadays, I've started playing again due to my daughter getting into it, and now my granddaughter is really getting into it. So we've started playing it again with the fifth edition stuff, and they've made it so much easier with all of the pre-written campaigns to go on. There's pre-written, pre-planned single shot games where it, you know, you come in with a brand new character, play for 2 hours, you know, do one adventure and then you're done, or you can continue those characters on to other adventures. You know,
Rick, thanks a lot for sharing. I love that you're playing a multi-generational D&D there. Ben, what do you think?
I think that that intergenerational experience is becoming happily common. Again, like it's something that, you know, my parents never really understood, but now it does seem to be a thing that you and your kids can do together. I have an 18-month-old, and one of my friends was like, "Oh, only 10 years until you have a new player in your D&D campaign." And I'm like, "Oh, yeah, that's true." Also, again, there has been a huge proliferation of materials for Dungeons & Dragons. Wizards of the Coast did something radical with the D&D intellectual property about 22 years ago, and they opened it up. Essentially, anyone who wants to can make their own D&D rulebooks, can make their own D&D settings, put them up for sale on the internet, and make money off them and not have to send Wizards of the Coast a dime. And the result of that really has been an incredible richness of settings and adventures and options for Dungeons & Dragons players. It may be, again, one of the reasons that you're seeing this exponential growth in players is that the IP is open. You know, it'd be like Disney saying anybody can make a Star Wars movie. It's crazy.
Thanks a lot for that call. We heard from Dan in West Salem who emailed about, it wasn't just TSR, but it was also the gaming convention Gen Con. It got really huge in Lake Geneva until it was finally moved, I think, to Indianapolis at some point. That was a big part of the story of Wisconsin's role in gaming, though, Ben.
Well, it's amazing. Gary Gygax also started Gen Con. You know, like, again, if you're looking for a reason to call Gary Gygax the most influential Wisconsinian of all time, he didn't only create a radical new medium. He created the largest tabletop and role-playing game convention in North America. It moved out of Lake Geneva to UW campuses. I forget which ones. Then it settled in Milwaukee for a good long time. And then when Wizards of the Coast bought Dungeons and Dragons, they ended up moving it to Indianapolis. And Indianapolis does do a really good job with it. Again, I feel like, you know, I'm a Milwaukeean. I went to Gen Con in Milwaukee. Indianapolis does a better job with the convention than we did. Again, it feels like Dungeons and Dragons, TSR, all of that has always been something that the state is more ashamed of than proud of. And I think it's one of the reasons we lost that convention.
Hmm. Let's go back to our callers now. Valerie is with us in Milwaukee. Valerie, hi.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. What you want to tell us about?
Sure. So I'm 30, and I wanted to play D&D for a long time, but I was always kind of intimidated by it. And I have been watching a lot more web programs like Dimension 20 and Critical Role, where you can watch people playing these really long, wonderfully creative campaigns. And I think it's great to make it more accessible. And I just started playing my own campaign a few months ago, and I just want to kind of bring up that new exciting aspect of it.
Valerie, thanks a lot for sharing that with us. Ben, yeah, there are a lot of things where you can watch other people playing D&D and other role-playing games.
Yeah, about huzzah for you, Valerie. About 14 years ago, I thought tabletop role-playing games were dead. I went and bought everything I wanted. I put it in my basement, and I thought, role-playing games are done. They've been killed by video games and the recession, and it's over now. People will look at it the way they look at Pet Rocks. But I could not have been more wrong. Both video games and the internet have been fantastic for tabletop role-playing games. Video games essentially teach you how to play role-playing games because they stole so much from Dungeons and Dragons, hit points, levels. And YouTube, which again, I thought people would be on there watching pirated South Park or something. Instead, YouTube is a gigantic engine for teaching people how to play Dungeons and Dragons with the best imaginable teachers, with voice actors and comedians playing the game, making it look, just amazing. You know, not only that, but tabletop role-playing game has something that electronics do not have, which is just you have to gather with other human beings and experience the animal warmth of your fellows, which, again, when we're online all day with Zoom, when we are just engaging more and more electronically, being able to get together with people and to have to get together with them to play this game, it's just a tonic and antidote to all of that.
Thanks for that call. And just our last minute, there is an effort to establish that statue that isn't there in Lake Geneva, I think, for Gary Gygax. What are you hoping for to get Wisconsin to recognize this part of its history?
Wow, that's a good question. I would say we could start with Governor Evers officially recognizing Gary Gygax Day, which just recently passed. Because, hey, again, if he's the most influential Wisconsinian of all time, we should at least take one day of the year and make it an official holiday here in Wisconsin. So that is what I will push for, sir, making Gary Gygax Day an official holiday in the state of Wisconsin.
All right, roll 20, difficulty 15 to make that happen, Ben. Ben, thanks a lot for joining us today. It's been a lot of fun.
My pleasure. I'll be anytime you want me on. Oh, and if you're really interested in D&D, you can see D&D sales numbers on my Twitter page. It's at @BenRiggs_.
Ben Riggs is a writer, teacher, and podcaster from Milwaukee. We've been talking about his new book. It's called Slaying the Dragon, A Secret History of Dungeons and Dragons, looking at the origins of this incredibly influential new kind of game. Got its start in Lake Geneva, Wisconsin. He tracks the twists and turns both on the creative side and the business side of things. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. The late-night television talk show landscape is set to change in the coming months, and the changes come as the future of the late-night format is in question. Earlier this year, James Corden announced he'll be leaving The Late Late Show next spring. More recently, Trevor Noah said he's stepping away from The Daily Show in December. Last year, Conan O'Brien ended his 28-year run as a late-night host, and TBS got out of the talk show wars entirely with the cancellation of Full Frontal with Samantha Bee this summer. The changes come as traditional late-night talk show television ratings have been declining since the heydays of Jay Leno and David Letterman in the 1990s. As more and more viewers and video content switch to online streaming, it leaves an unclear future for late-night talk shows that once dominated American popular culture. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you watch late-night talk shows yourself in real time, or do you watch funny bits when they pop up on some form of social media or YouTube the next day? Were these kind of shows once part of your regular viewing at night, whether we're going back to Carson or Leno or Letterman or pick your era? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. John Koblin is a media reporter for the New York Times covering the TV industry. He's co-author of the book It's Not TV, The Spectacular Rise, Revolution, and Future of HBO. John, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks, Rob, for having me on.
Before we get into some of the specific changes lately, can you talk about the big picture trends that led from, you know, the only game in town pretty much was talk shows at late night for a long time, and now not so much?
Yeah, you know, you did a great job summing up all these departures that are coming up. And this has happened in late night before. In 2014 and 2015, we saw Jay Leno, Dave Letterman, and Jon Stewart all depart at relatively, in a sort of truncated period of time. And at that point, 7 or 8 years ago, the entire television industry and news media was interested in on the short list. Who's going to replace these hosts? There's something different about these departures this time. When James Corden announced he was leaving, the president of CBS said, we're not going to stick with the same old host behind a desk format. We're going to think about something else. And Trevor Noah's replacement for The Daily Show, that might be a multi-host reformatted show as well. When you talk to producers in the late night field, they say that there's something different this time. And the something different, diminished ratings, less revenue, NBC has considered spinning off Seth Meyers' 12:30 show on NBC. They have considered spinning that off to MSNBC. So it's a pretty challenged genre. And I think it is fair to ask the question at this point, what is the future of the late night show?
Yeah, the content of late night shows doesn't necessarily fit well with streaming, right? The Game of Thrones, say you watch that when it first breaks or 2 days later or 2 years later, still the same show. That topical monologue at the beginning of a late night show doesn't make sense 2 days or 2 weeks later.
Yeah, this is probably the biggest challenge. As we've seen with both scripted entertainment and even unscripted entertainment, it has made the transition from network television, cable television, to streaming very, very nicely. Late night shows depend on topicality. They depend on what people are talking about that day, or at least within the last few days. And that is not how people experience streaming entertainment. Netflix was really, they really made a hard effort to make a talk show work 5-6 years ago. They gave a talk show to Chelsea Handler. They gave one to Joel McHale. They gave one to Hasan Minhaj. None of them worked, and all of them were canceled. Hulu, similarly, they gave a show to Sarah Silverman. That was canceled after only a handful of episodes. Apple TV Plus, they just gave a show to Jon Stewart. The second season recently began, but the first season really had a tough time garnering significant attention. So late night, as we know it, going back to the Johnny Carson days and then evolved by David Letterman and then spun forward by Conan O'Brien and Jimmy Fallon and Stephen Colbert, that show where you have a host who does a monologue, sits behind the desk, does a funny sketch, does a celebrity interview, that just does not work on streaming.
Before he announced he was leaving The Daily Show, Trevor Noah was asked by an audience member what he thought the future of late night comedy would look like. Here's what he said.
Content is evergreen, right? There will always be content. I think when we consume content, will change. Like, some people go, this is a late night show. Some people don't think of it as a late night. They just go, it's a show. Then some people don't even think of it as a TV show. They go like, I love your show on YouTube. I love your show on TikTok. I love you on Snapchat. I love you on Facebook. I love, like, there's some people who go, if I go like, I have a TV show, they're like, what TV? Where? And they have no clue at all. My brother taught me this, my younger brother. He doesn't watch TV at all, but he's seen everything that's on TV.
Do you see that changing the content, John, where, okay, as opposed to doing something that's going to work in my live broadcast, I'm going to do something that's going to work for people to click on YouTube or Instagram or whatever?
Yeah, I think we saw that change when Jimmy Fallon took the reins of The Tonight Show in 2014. He really was creating content for it to go viral on YouTube. James Corden as well. That's where Carpool Karaoke began and became a huge hit. It became a huge hit on YouTube and not necessarily on CBS. The difference between now and then is the ratings have fallen even farther from where they were 8 years ago. And most significantly, the revenue has diminished. Most producers I talk to believe the genre will continue in some way in 5 or 10 years. It's just going to look radically different than it does today, mostly because we have to figure out how does this work on the internet? How does this work digitally?
We're talking with New York Times media reporter John Coblin about changes in late night talk shows and where they could go from here. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What role do you think the late night talk show plays in American culture, or played past tense in American culture? Is there one you still watch live, or do you catch up the next day on? Fill in the blank there. Did you used to consistently watch one of the late night talk show hosts? Who was your favorite from the days of yore, whether that was 3 years ago or 30 years ago? 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up the conversation with, here's John Coblin, media reporter for the New York Times, who covers the television industry. With us today, looking at changes coming to late night TV talk shows and the challenges those programs face in the streaming age. could join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think the future holds for late night talk shows? What question you have about the changes that have been happening that may be coming in the future? Do you care who replaces James Corden on The Late Late Show, Trevor Noah on The Daily Show, or if those shows go away altogether? Was there a show in the past that, yeah, you really watch that all the time? What changed for you? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring out a caller. Mike is with us in Waukesha. Mike, hi.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Mike?
So it was interesting. I'm just driving on my way here in Waukesha, Wisconsin. I got to go pay a bill. But we were talking about why the late night people like Trevor Noah and why these shows are, let's say, being off the air, canceled, what have you. I have a suspicion that it's content as it relates to what people are calling the woke agenda and the woke mentality, in which late night used to be entertaining. It used to be funny. It even provided a little bit of variety. If you ask me, you know, the days of Carson, even Letterman, Leno. But what you didn't see the political push, it seems. And there's a saying out there. It says, get woke, go broke. While other people on YouTube and on Internet are doing quite well, the Rogans, the Tim Pools, Jordan Peterson, Russell Brand, they're growing. They're huge. So I don't necessarily think it's technology somewhat. I just think it's content, really.
Mike, I gotcha. Thanks for the call. We had another caller who was also worried about politics on these shows, liberal politics, they said, sneaking in. What do you think, John?
I mean, it cannot be discounted. Obviously, it's a factor. You know, ever since, much the way America has gone, late night television is gone. Once things started getting more divisive, and particularly when Donald Trump entered the fray in 2015 and then won the election in 2016, we've seen many of the late night hosts take on a more political bent to their shows, particularly Stephen Colbert, who's the most watched host in late night. His show has become a very political show that it cannot be discounted. It absolutely has to be considered a factor if you are turning off potentially half the audience. However, we also cannot discount the really the technological, the seismic technological shift. I mean, Rob, I was smiling when you came back from break and you're playing the Tonight Show theme. You know, that when the Tonight Show was on, when Johnny Carson was hosting it, when Jay Leno hosted it, you had America watching NBC from 8 to 11 p.m., watching their local news at 11, and then they just transitioned right into Johnny at 11:30. You had millions of people doing that every night. Those habits are broken permanently. You do not have even close to the same number of viewers watching NBC or CBS or ABC between 8 and 10, 11, between 8 and 11 p.m. And if you have fewer people to begin with, you have fewer people sticking around for 11:30 and 12:30.
Is there, do you see any way to bring back that kind of common language again, where people are saying, hey, did you see who was on Carson last night or something like that? Or is that something we just can't go back to, given all the variety out there?
I think it's extremely possible. And many of the late night producers and former producers who I spoke to are optimistic that something could work. One producer posited an interesting solution to me. Now, Thursday Night Football is on the Amazon streaming service. You have 10, 11, 12 million people who are watching it on Amazon every week. When that ends, is there some sort of show that Amazon could put on, a topical live show afterwards, where people stick around for another hour? Is it going to look like the traditional late night show? No, but could you bring elements of the genre into something like that for sort of this big event programming, especially as it slowly makes its transition to streaming? That is a compelling theory, and it could work.
Now, with the couple changes we mentioned, Trevor Noah and James Corden, each on their shows for about 7 years before announcing their departures, here's a Corden talking to the entertainment news program Extra about the length of his stay on the show.
By the time we finish, I'll have done pretty much like 1,400 episodes. That's a lot. And I know that in America, these jobs are positions that people take for 10, 15, 20, 25 years. It was never, ever going to be that for me.
Yeah, who'd want to host the same talk show for more than 7 years? I don't know about that. But this idea, I mean, it used to be like, you know, you're the Pope almost. This is a lifetime appointment once you landed that late night gig. And now it seems like, I don't know, a lot of the hosts have other things they could do out there.
Yeah, that's another big part of this. As we've learned with both the Corden and Trevor Noah departures, they don't see it as a lifetime appointment, and they don't want a lifetime appointment. Trevor Noah, when he broke the news to viewers that he was leaving The Daily Show, he had told very few people that he was doing that. Much of his staff didn't know, and more significantly, his bosses didn't know. He completely blindsided them, and I think it was because he just wanted to get it out of the way, announce his departure on his terms so he could leave within a couple months, and he will be gone by December. Yeah, I mean, it's a grind. These are very hard jobs, and these hosts have a lot more options now. Take Conan O'Brien. Conan O'Brien had been in late night for nearly three decades. His show on TBS, they reformatted it within the last 2 years of its life, reducing it to a half hour and focusing on one guest for an interview. It didn't work. The ratings were really, really, really low for that show. But guess what happened? Conan O'Brien had a side project going. He had a podcast, a long-form interview program, interviewing other celebrities or journalists or interesting people. That is a huge hit. It's a huge hit. And Conan O'Brien just sold his podcast network to SiriusXM. So it really was a matter of genre, where Conan O'Brien was doing it. Late night wasn't working, but podcast does.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Paul is with us in San Jose, Costa Rica. Paul, hi.
Hello, hello. Greetings.
What did you want to bring up, Paul?
Frequent listener from abroad. I've lived abroad for decades. I always watch the shows you're talking about. I watch them online. Thank God that they're streamed so I can see them, because I wouldn't have access to them otherwise. So I think a lot of us watch those shows, whether it's the entire show of Colbert or Trevor Noah, or we're just clicking on the interviews and pieces that we want to see, and I would be really upset to lose them. Much less, I don't agree that it's about woke content at all. I think they're always topical, and they keep me abreast of what's going on, and I enjoy the humor, and it's part of my day to always check in with them.
And Paul, I gotta ask, you mentioned sometimes you just click on interviews. Do you ever watch, you know, in real time live when those shows are broadcast?
I never do. I don't know that I ever have.
Gotcha. Paul, thanks a lot for sharing that. Interesting perspective there, John, on how he uses that.
Completely. I you know what? He is like a lot of people out there. There are the thousands and millions of people who are going to go ahead and click on a YouTube of what was Colbert's monologue last night. Oh, I heard Jimmy Fallon had Olivia Wilde on his show last night. I will watch that. And this worked for a while because there were enough viewers coming into the broadcast network where the network executives were happy. They were making plenty of money and sure, let it be a hit on YouTube. The problem is simply the economics. You're making pennies on the dollar with those YouTube clicks. They just, if the viewers are not tuning in at high numbers into the network, the YouTube stuff just doesn't make economic sense. And these media companies have done a better job at moving a lot of this content to their own proprietary streaming services. But again, you know, how many subscribers are you going to get because you want to watch Stephen Colbert, you watch Jimmy Fallon? It may not be enough to justify the expenses of these shows. And these shows cost a lot of money. They could cost anywhere on a yearly basis between $60 and $100 million to produce.
Let's bring on another caller now. Richard is with us in Two Rivers. Richard, hi.
Yeah, hi.
What did you want to bring up, Richard?
I want to bring up the fact that, I'm talking to some other people right now.
Oh, okay. I'll let you go then, Richard. Let's go to Charles in Merrill. Charles, hi.
Hi there. I was wondering what your guest thought of John Oliver's show. I don't know if he'd consider it a late night show or not, but he has, you know, kind of exactly what the last caller was talking about, lots of topical, societal and political, you know, topics on videos on YouTube that are fantastic. I think he's on HBO, and we've considered getting HBO because we love his show so much.
Interesting, Charles. You've written a bit, I think, John, about HBO. Thoughts on John Oliver and if he would actually be, you know, getting people to subscribe?
It's such a great question, Charles. I would say John Oliver is kind of the exception to the rule here, but he does something different, right? He's a weekly show, and he's not on 52 weeks a year. It's less than that, but it's a weekly show. It's a 30-minute show. And he usually does a little, you know, song and dance. He does like, you know, does some comedy bits at the top, but it's usually a single topic. And it's kind of a journalistic show, too. But for the purposes of the genre, I do think it counts as a late night show. In fact, it has won the Best Variety Talk Show Emmy Award, I believe, 7 years in a row, beating Colbert, beating Kimmel, beating Seth Meyers, year in and year out. I think one of the things that benefited John Oliver is his show started before the streaming era really began to dominate entertainment. It started as an HBO proper show. So I think he has successfully made the transition to the other side, where plenty of people are watching him on HBO Max, even if not as many people are watching him on HBO, the cable network. But John Oliver is an example of a success story here.
And speaking of shows that, like, do they fit the genre? People have pointed toward Greg Gutfeld on Fox News. So it's a more conservative-leaning sort of talk show on a network where people, you know, the built-in audience would match up well with that. Where does that fit into this discussion?
It's a late-night political and comedy show, and it is definitely worked. I mean, you know, Fox has... it's an 11 p.m. show. Fox has done a number of experiments at 11 p.m., and this is the one that's taken hold. Many network executives sort of bristle at the comparison that Gutfeld is the same genre as what they're doing. And notably, they will point out that he is live at 8 p.m. on the West Coast, so he gets to goose his numbers even more. And also, Fox viewers are very loyal to their network. They will stay from afternoon until night. So there is a smooth transition from Tucker to Laura Ingraham to Hannity to Gutfeld.
Now, bringing things around, you recently co-wrote a piece headlined, "Is There a Future for Late Night Talk Shows?" What are you watching for in the future? Is there going to be a late night talk show, or are we going to translate this all into, I don't know, YouTube and podcast video series? What are you watching for in the future?
In the short term, let's see who replaces Trevor Noah. Let's see who replaces James Corden. I suspect both Comedy Central and CBS are going to try to shake up the format. Not many networks have tried to shake up the format. So let's see if those efforts are successful. I have a careful eye on Stephen Colbert's contract is up next year. Does he re-sign? If he re-signs, is it a short 1 or 2 year deal, or is it a 3-4 year deal? The Tonight Show, NBC is considering giving up its 10 p.m. primetime hour and giving it to local affiliates. Does the Tonight Show move up to 10:30 or 11 p.m. if so? And does that work? Do more viewers come in to watch it? And similarly, what happens to Seth Meyers at 12:30? It's a popular show. It's a niche show, but it always gets critical recognition. Does that continue to run at 12:30, or do NBC executives decide to put it on their streaming service or on their cable news network?
And finally, John, you know, if I'm watching TV after 10 o'clock, it's either I'm still watching a live sporting event, or I'm pulling up something to stream, probably, you know, a TV show of some sort, fictionalized TV show. Are people like me killing this late night talk show format?
Luckily, you're not alone, so we don't have to single you out, Rob. Yes, we are collectively really getting it closer to life support because we're just not watching the way we did 3 years ago, 5 years ago, 10 years ago.
John, thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks so much.
John Coblin is a media reporter for the New York Times covering the television industry. He was with us today looking at the present and future of late night television talk shows in the streaming age. Still time for you to share your thoughts, maybe your all-time favorite. If you had one you watched reliably every night, if you could, let us know over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. I'm Rob Barrett. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.